You can get ad-free episodes of the Forest School podcast, as well as bonus episodes and exclusive access to upcoming guests to ask them questions before anybody else finds out about it, simply by visiting patreon.com/children of the forest. Hello, hello, hello. We're going to do this very fast. Listen to the start of the podcast. Okay, thank you for listening.
Super speed. We've got a waffle chat for you today. It's a delicious waffle chat all about attention restoration therapy, which you may or may not have heard of. We haven't heard of it until quite recently. And it's basically a theory that we're going to explain in detail in the podcast, but it's about whether nature can help our brains when they are struggling with attention and becoming fatigued. But before we go into that, news, updates, and opportunities. This is my jingle.
This is incredibly low effort.
For news. And,
you've set the bar so high in Song Wars.
What do you mean? I've spent ages working on this. It's like a news bulletin.
Yeah. I got it, mate.
Children of the Forest. Do you want to be outdoors? Great.
No, what we've got coming up, we've got more spots for volunteering. We've had some amazing volunteers in the past, and I'm sure we'll have more amazing volunteers in the future. It's a really cool way for, like, if you want to sort of dip your toes into Forest School, or if you're doing your training and you want to come learn a bit more and do your pilot sessions, or if you just want to come hang out in the woods for a bit and, like, be with some cool people and part of a cool community. It's a nice thing to do. There's information all about our volunteering on our website.
It's under the vacancies tab, which
hidden away
under the vacancies tab. We would love to hear from you if you are interested in coming to the woods and hanging out with us. And also coming up in September, we've got our next cohort of level 3 Forest School Leader trainees starting with us. And that cohort
does that have a jingle?
I'm afraid it doesn't. No. Oh. No.
Should I do one?
Yeah.
A level 3.
Nice. Oh my goodness. That's on Mondays, isn't it? That's like 5 Mondays, September, October time.
Yes.
And then another 5 Mondays later on in the spring.
We moved it back because this cohort just gone. They came back in the spring to do their five Mondays again. And the bluebells went up. So we were like, well, this is rubs. We're going to move the dates back so that this next cohort, they'll get to see all our lovely English bluebell woods as part of their 5 sessions. And it's a nice way because doing it split means that we get to see the woods in the autumn and in the spring, and there's like different opportunities and things to learn from all those different, you know, and seeing it like come to life in the spring. Oh, it's lush.
And time to do your portfolio and coursework like in between so that you don't feel so lonely when, you know, if you just do some practical face-to-face stuff and then you just go off and do it all by yourself, that's kind of lonely and sad. So
With only an email address to send things to.
Oh, imagine.
I know.
It's loneliness.
I like looking at our lovely mugs.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Let's get into it.
Some attention restoration.
I'm Wem.
And I'm Lewis.
This is the Forest School Podcast.
Let's go! So, I was reading a thing this morning about someone did some like massive research about great apes spinning and like making themselves dizzy and looked at like humans spinning and making themselves dizzy and like why do they do it and how fast do they do it and what's the link? And it's really interesting that someone went to the effort of like part of their research was looking at videos of great apes, so chimpanzees, gorillas and orangutans all spinning and measuring the rate and then listing the like axes that they were spinning on And then comparing that to professional and non-professional human spinners, in quotes. Mm-hmm. So like ballet dancers, looking at the rotations and all this stuff. So interesting. They were like, part of it is they're thinking, part of it is like just seeking an altered sense of reality.
Yeah.
In that same way that like psychedelics and, you know, anything that gives you an altered sense is like part of human evolution. But also that it might be to do with like, in quotes, programmed into us as children to like get dizzy so that your proprioception goes up and you're not, you don't get motion sick. So when you're moving through the trees in a panicked sense, you're like ready to operate at like super dizzy levels. Mm-hmm. And that means that you're then like walking around is like, well, this is on easy mode now. And it's really like,
oh my God, that weirdly links with something I'm reading about dyslexia, about, I think it's called like cognitive distortion or something, about how infants' brains do that. So that altered sense of reality.
Yeah.
And that you can, like, it's a kind of, as a brain mode that you, if you see something that you don't understand because you've never seen it before, yeah, you can kind of almost deliberately put yourself into this altered state so that you get a better conception of what the thing is. I need to read a bit more about it, but basically that is, and it helps you to comprehend the world because you can start seeing things from different perspectives and start creating, like, filling in gaps, basically, a bit like a mental thing of, you know, when like we watch films,
three-dimensional modeling.
Yeah. Or like, sort of going, right, I can, this is the thing I can literally see, but yeah, I'm gonna fill in some gaps by kind of taking an imaginative leap about what the thing might look like from another angle, or connect it with something I've seen before. It's really weird, but the theory is that dyslexics do that too much, that they get they have got into the habit of going into like cognitive distortion. But you, it's very helpful actually in infant stages that you can disorientate yourself.
Is it, I wonder like if it's similar trying thing. To si- is it like, I'm really simplifying what you've said down into like a very silly idea now, is it like, you know, like you have to go a bit fuzzy to look at a magic eye picture,
yeah,
but then it works, and then is it like your brain,
maybe, like
is it then going,
I'm going to report back because, okay, I've only read like the first chapter of this book. And
oh, well, let's just make some sweeping statements.
Exactly. That's what I thought I might do. But it just reminded me of what you're saying in terms of that infant brain getting disoriented. And that is, yeah, the terminology that they use in the book. Anyway, fascinating.
Very, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and getting disoriented does link,
yes,
to this topic that you sent through.
Yeah. So I came across this ages ago and meant to get into it and just remembered today. So found this thing called Attention Restoration Therapy, or ART, by the Kaplans. I'm just going to look at their
Stephen
first
and
names.
Rachel Kaplan.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So it's basically very relevant to Forest School because it's the theory that time spent in natural environments can help with focus and concentration, but it's a kind of quite a specific theory, isn't it, with sort of, yes, stages to it and things like that. And I found an article which sort of sums it up, which is on a website called positivepsychology.com, if anyone wanted to read the full article, which is what is Kaplan's attention restoration theory. And then I also found, interestingly, an article, some research basically that was conducted at the University of Exeter, which is really close to us, which is more of a kind of systematic review of, mm-hmm, of the theory and whether it actually holds up. And I must be honest, I didn't get to the end of that particular article because it was quite long and quite deep. So maybe we should start with like the kind of summary. What did you think when you read the kind of summary?
Did it
chime with you?
Well, I think some of it definitely struck me as one of those things where someone's observed this, not someone, the world kind of understands this phenomenon, and a lot of things like that can go a really long time before they're ever like categorized or sort of investigated in any, like, I think the word is empirical way, you know, you just that. And anybody, I don't think anybody listening to this podcast would go, I've never heard of this idea that like being in nature is like calming for your brain or that helps, you know, we all know it. And it, sometimes it can take a while for someone to go, how does that work though? Or like, or because there is an idea that it works because of reasons X, Y, and Z. And then someone goes, well, have we ever actually tested that? Because what if it's to do with A or B or C? So it's quite interesting seeing something quite big taken down into like, okay, but can we work out what the process is of doing this? So that's interesting in itself.
Yeah. Shall I try and sum up like some of what their theory is?
Yeah.
I'll try. And then you can like intervene. So,
okay.
Or interject. So the first kind of terminology that I came across was that the term known as directed or voluntary attention. Mm-hmm. And so that is your ability to focus on a task that requires effort. So we're in the midst of distraction. So they give an example of like having to complete your tax return while your kids are playing outside. So you've got like that kind of noisy distraction, and probably it's not something that you are like, yummy, my tax return. Oh, I just can't wait. That you are really having to be like, right, no, come on, knuckle down, focus, you have to do it. And so that directed attention and your ability to do that is finite, and it can become fatigued. Mm-hmm. So it's specifically this theory based on that like voluntary directed attention and your ability to have that skill. So I guess it's a type of executive functioning, but it is like literally that. It's like, how is your ability, your skill at going, I need to focus on this thing. It might not necessarily be because I flipping love it, but I have to. In the face of distractions and go on.
There's another theory, isn't there? There's some academic work around the idea of the term grit, which is like defined as that, like that determination, that going through it being challenging, but that's more
resilience.
That's what I was going to say. So this is like, I feel like it's adjacent to that idea of grit though, because it's not about like, actually that example of the tax return and the kids is really good, because when I was reading this, and as I understand it, it's not necessarily to do with like ignoring the children and doing the tax return. It's about like coming back to the thing and how much effort that takes to come back to the thing, or to like spin two plates at the same time. It's not about being able to like put your horse blinkers on, knuckle down, get the thing done. It's more about I also feel like it's like next to that decision fatigue, it's like willpower fatigue.
Yeah, well, it actually says that, and says that this kind of attentional fatigue is particularly important because it's associated. So if you've got this fatigue, it's associated with poorer decision making, lower levels of self-control, which in turn have been linked to lots of health related issues like obesity, because you're not in that like absolute present, I am in control of myself, I can think about, I can focus on it type thing. And feelings of irritability, basically, which it makes sense, doesn't it? If you've got that kind of, you're fatigued in terms of your attention span, and you become really crotchety and cross. And the theory is kind of born around the trend of urban living and increasingly indoor work and play, and lots of demands upon that part of our brain, that part of our attention. So we're all going to be naturally gifted with different amounts of that sort of attention skill in that particular area. But the writers of this theory kind of posit that everybody in modern life is getting more and more fatigued in this area because of the stimuli that we're being exposed to in urban areas and in indoor settings, which kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so that's why they came up with this, like, and the answer to this fatigue state that we're all getting into is to spend time in nature. But they're quite specific about what the sort of process is in terms of being out in nature. It's not just like, and just be in nature and then you'll be better. Like, there is a kind of process that
they've put
through.
Well, that's what I was saying, I think, a minute ago about it just being like that known thing of like being in nature will help you do whatever. They've kind of gone, but it's not just that, there are components or processes that, you know, which might explain, I think, examples where people are like, this I actually find going here quite stressful, you know, there's like outliers whenever someone talks about like, I just love being in nature, or all the kids are so much better when they're here, or to like understanding or having an idea of this process. I think as I was reading through gave me lots of examples of like, if you think of it like medicine, it's almost like, oh, that's why the medicine wasn't working for you, or oh, that's why the medicine didn't work when we did it this way. Or
can
like,
you give an example of that?
So,
I wonder if it's the same as mine.
Well, I can, but I think I would be, it would result in me jumping around.
Okay, cool. So, shall I go through the kind of restoration process ethos?
Yes,
like,
I think
that
would be
helpful. So they think that there are four steps to the restoration process. So once you're in nature and you're trying to basically restore and your capacity for this type of focus attention, the first one is clearer head or concentration. The second one is mental fatigue recovery. The third one is soft fascination or interest. And the fourth one is reflection or restoration. And the key components to the kind of process is, number one, being away, which I thought was a really nice way of phrasing it. So that idea that you are away from your usual thoughts, concerns, world, you know, you're just, you're being picked up. And they did say you didn't necessarily have to be physically away from them. So I'm guessing that means that you might actually be in your garden. You don't need to be like in a completely new, amazing, mind-blowing natural space. But it is that you are being somehow taken out of your usual routine, your usual kind of thoughts and concerns. And number two, soft fascination, which again, I found like a really interesting thing. So being in an environment where you are interested, you're fascinated by what's around you, but there's a difference between soft fascination and hard fascination. And soft being that your attention is held really gently, as opposed to like, oh my God, check this out, this is incredible, whoa, you know, your attention is just being held in a really gentle way. So at the same time as being absorbed by something, you are all, a part of your brain is also able to reflect and think about like bigger things like your life goals or your emotions and things like that. And I thought that that was really relevant to forest school, and that made me think about stuff like, there are times at forest school where there's definitely like hard fascination with, you know, in the natural world. And, but soft fascination is things like doing handwork outside. So, you know, you're weaving or you're playing with clay or you're doing those things where you are fascinated by what you're doing. You are absorbed, but you do have space. I'm kind of gesturing towards like the back right hand side of my skull, which isn't that interesting. I keep doing it. That must be where that happens in my brain. Anyway, that's really weird. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting and did really chime for me with the whole like low arousal approach. Did you think of that as you were reading this?
Yes. So I think if I can finish that list and then I'll after soft fascination, they then talk about like the extent and then compatibility. Word that sounds like that.
Compatibility.
Yeah, not combative. Not compatibility.
Do you want to talk about what extent it meant?
Well, I couldn't really get my head around the extent bit to a degree.
I understood it to be that the environment is in some way familiar to you. So it doesn't have to be a place that you know well, but it needs to be similar enough to environments that you have been in before to be chill. So the kind of low arousal thing. And so that you don't feel out of place.
Well, yeah.
And
so
that really rang kind of bells for me. It's got to be somewhat familiar in order to be restorative. And I guess that is the low arousal thing, because if you're somewhere like imagine you're in like an incredible natural environment with like huge waterfalls or amazing mountains. And like, yeah, the effect it's going to have on you is positive, probably. But it's not the same as this whole kind of theory, because in order to be restorative and to give you that clear head, that concentration, that ability to reflect, it's got to be kind of similar to somewhere you've been before, or somewhere where you can, somewhere, something you can connect with, so that you're not on high alert, you're not like highly aroused and going, oh my God, or am I safe, or what's that?
There's too much to process.
Oh my God, there's a noise I've never heard before. Exactly. So it's got to be chill.
Yeah.
Basically.
Now we've done that, you asked me if there were any things that struck out to me as, like, you know, this thing. And a big one for me was that first thing of being away, and not necessarily physically being away, but mentally, emotionally, spiritually, perhaps being away, in quotes. And I actually think that ties in to the podcast we did, if it wasn't the last one, it was very recent, about whether sit spots work and whether nature connection can happen on your own. And that is that being away thing just ties into that idea, I think, of, like, you know, maybe that's an underlying thing, just to go back to that idea of, like, why don't sit spots work in pairs, or why do we feel like it's a different experience in pairs? And, like, is there something there that we knew that they weren't, you know, participants or learners or whatever you want to call it, weren't getting that mental fatigue recovery, attention recovery, in that situation, because they weren't getting that being away part.
Yeah.
But that's different to their nature connection thing, which is what we were asking in that podcast. This is specifically about, like, is their attention being, like, is their attention cup being refilled?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, that being away thing, it is harder to get it refilled, I think. The soft fascination thing I found really interesting because, like you say, it's that description of gently holding your attention. But as I think everybody who works with young people in particular will have experienced, one activity or play cue or offering, springboard, can evoke hard fascination from some people and soft fascination from other people. Mm-hmm. And when they overlap or clash, that can be a really interesting thing of, like, what an offering that you might go, this would really give that person some headspace if they can, you know, because I think they would enjoy the therapeutic, like, clay is a great example, the therapeutic offering of clay and making a worm and a coil pot. Someone else has the same offering, but hard fascination needs to start chucking it hard at a tree or at their own boots or that sort of unpredictability, or that, I don't feel like you can scaffold necessarily hard or soft fascination. You can only observe it after it's happened.
Yes. Although I do wonder whether it's one of those things where once you are aware of it and as a theory and as a opportunity, it's an opportunity for somebody to I like that phrase you just had, like, refill their attention cup, that it might affect one's planning of a forest school session in terms of what you're offering and when. And if you're thinking about, kind of, if you could graph the energy of a group, and probably a group that you know well, and you can kind of make, as you say, you don't know for sure, but you can make some rough predictions maybe about how people are going to react to certain opportunities, that you could have you could just make sure that in your planning you are giving time and space for this soft fascination somewhere in there, and you go, okay, well, with this group, that's unlikely to happen near the beginning because they're going to arrive with a lot of energy, or this thing has just changed in the woods at the moment, and so they're going to be really fixated on that, or they've been away a long time, or all those things. And you go, but I reckon maybe, like, after lunch, you've got a bit of time there where if I put these resources out, or if I start doing something as an invitation, they might engage with that, and that might be when I'm likely to get that kind of response or interaction with that thing. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Like, you can't control it, as you're saying, but it might just be a really nice thing to be aware of for its capacity for benefit for people.
Do you think, yes, 100%, exactly, yes, 100%. Do you think hard and soft fascination is a really interesting tool, I think, to look at? You know, we talk frequently about that idea of like, if you're in a school, like senior leadership coming out or Ofsted coming out or somebody coming to watch your session. Mm-hmm. And do you think there's something about soft focus looks to outside observers like less good, like less good or like less beneficial, that like if you wanted to, like if you're in a, I feel like when I was in a classroom or when I was working in schools, if someone was coming to observe my session, what they, and they were, you know, that box of like, were the children engaged?
Mm.
What they're actually asking, if you look, take this lens, is like, was there hard fascination throughout? And how,
which that, is actually almost the type of attention this is talking about. It's that directional attention. So was there that throughout? And it's like, well, if you want any of that, you need to flip and give people some time off of that.
No, hard focus, 6 hours a day at the drop of a hat.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
But I just think that's interesting, again, to have that in your like vocabulary or your pedagogical toolkit to be able to go, do you know what? We did a load of hard focusing this morning. Mm. And so I want to give them some opportunity for soft focus to build that battery back up, to fill that cup and have this kind of tangential transient kind of level of attention span. That's what we're doing right now. That's beneficial. And that having that in your back pocket is another like amazing lens to offer people, like, no, they are not all hard focused on measuring worms, but they are, you know, we're doing something social emotional right now. What we're doing is this.
Yeah. Can I lead on from that to the other, to their other aspects of compatibility, they say? So we've got that, like being away, soft fascination, extent, and compatibility. And compatibility, we didn't mention, was about being there through choice. They're the key components, aren't they?
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So we didn't really talk about compatibility, which was that idea that they have to be there through choice, that they're there from a intrinsic motivation type point of view rather than extrinsic. And further to that, they have some other examples of compatibility. And I didn't write all of those down, but the ones that stuck out to me were...
I have the list. Do you want the list?
Oh, do you? Yeah, go on.
Okay, so, because I think these were also like light bulb moments for me of like, oh, these are why these things didn't work.
Yeah.
So aspects of compatibility. Distraction, brackets, the environment should not be distracting because it's highly stimulating, but because it requires little effort to sink into. Again, amazing. Deficit of information. A restorative environment does not require the individual to search for information to make sense of it. That's huge. The individual should already have all the information needed to understand and enjoy the environment.
Low arousal.
Well, low arousal. And that to me is the meeting them where they are thing, that like should have all the understanding to make sense of the world, the environment. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Danger. The environment cannot be dangerous in any sense of the word. Questionable, but maybe not questionable for this restorative thing.
Yeah.
Sorry. Danger. The environment cannot be dangerous in any sense of the word, whether physically or due to fear of looking foolish or acting inappropriately. That to me was that like social emotional safe harbor. You know, that's the community building space. You've got to be, free of punishment and reward and all those manipulative things, and just be like, this is safe. There's absolutely everything here for you.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one to look alongside anytime we think about like risk at Forest School and risky play, because we talk so often about kind of the positive benefits of risky play and of exactly that like, it's not just about using axes and knives and fire. It's about the risk of like putting yourself out there socially or telling a joke in front of other people or whatever. And that those opportunities are really beneficial. But this is kind of the flip side to that, isn't it? This is the like, yes, but if you are looking for some opportunities for people to restore their attention, then that is not part of that. Those risky opportunities actually are just on the back burner for now, that it's actually none of that. Just none of that.
Thanks to everybody that's rating and reviewing the podcast on Spotify and on iTunes. It really helps to get the podcast in front of more people and helps us spread the word about the amazing thing that is Forest School.
Yeah. Or that you don't have to do those things right now.
Yeah.
That you can opt into them or stay with them. Deception. The individual should not be experiencing a discrepancy between the task they are doing and their true feelings about it. Woo. That's a beefy one.
Can you say more about that? Because I don't really get that.
So
how did you understand that?
I would understand that to mean that deception in that sense. Sorry, I'm going to read it again just to make a sense of it. So the individual should not be experiencing a discrepancy between the task they're doing and their true feelings about it. And I think that is that I'm doing this to please my friends.
Right.
I'm doing this to please the teacher, or I'm not doing this because I feel that I will be laughed at if I do it, or I'm not doing that. You know, like, it's got to be that, like, I don't want to say filterless, but like barrierless kind of like, how do you feel about painting watercolors? Because the watercolors are out and you shouldn't have to feel like you are painting watercolor. You know, paint that way. Just that, like, if you're basically to me, that says, like, if you're masking in any way, in any major way, you are not giving yourself a chance to restore your attention.
Yeah, love it. That makes sense to me now.
Great.
And because, actually, very relevant to adults, don't you think?
Hugely.
You know,
so much of this.
Because it's really, you know, if you're running for a school or for a, you know, something for adults and you offered some stuff, so many of them would do it and go, oh, this is just great, isn't it? I love doing this. And actually, they flipping are not enjoying it.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that so many of them would.
No,
but
no.
That potential is there. We're just kind
of... anything you do with adults. So I would say there's a few scenarios where that comes up in our work. One is where you see that come up because people are masking for the sake of, like, they're masking till they get on board. So, like, we're wonky people. And sometimes if we have a group of like level threes or people on a CPD course, I can feel people masking that first bit. And we're sort of going, or I'm at least going, well, thank you for masking and at least giving this a go. I hope that you get to a place soon with this where you don't have to mask. But I'm aware that that's then not restoring their attention. The other bit is when you see families where one of the adults in the family is doing a discrepancy because they're for a variety of reasons, whether they don't want to pass on an anxiety or they want to ensure they're having a good, either their kids are having a good time or because they want to make sure that they get the most out of that time that they're within the woods. You see that discrepancy where they're masking, going sometimes over the top of, like, yes, let's, oh, this is like, you go, okay, you're doing this, like, you're working right now is essentially what I see, and I go, that's great and it has a benefit, but I'm also taking account of that and to go, you might need some rest later, and that's what this is saying.
And makes then sense.
Last one, difficulty. The environment must not be one which individuals need to prepare or anticipate difficult situations to navigate. So that's interesting. And that is really strikes me. A lot of these strike me as like neurotypically not that challenging. If for a neurodivergent person, I can see all of this being like, this is why it's tiring for lots of people to do these different things, because if you're going to say to, you know, depending on how someone is neurodivergent, if you were going to go, oh, cool, I'm going to set up an environment where, like, nothing is a threat to you or there's no need to process extra information, you can't do that because that's internal. That's not, you know, that's, I'm tripping over my words here, but lots of those struck me as, like, that's why this is extra beneficial, but also extra challenging.
To facilitate. Yes, I agree. And kind of harking back to what you said about the kind of classroom analogy that you were saying, like, somebody walks in and your whole class is like playing with clay or weaving or something whilst listening to some music, or they're just sitting in the school garden doing something that meets these criteria, and your head teacher goes, what the heck is you doing? Like, and you're like, well, I'm doing it so that we can do maths, or because we did maths and now we need to do something else. That traditionally that would be viewed as that's playtime. So playtime is the time where you do that. Mm-hmm. That's what playtime is. And once you read this, you're like, is playtime free from distraction? Is playtime not dangerous? Is playtime not there? You know, you're not at playtime because of a sense of duty. Do you know what I mean? All those things. Yeah. It's like, it doesn't meet any of this restorative, like attention restorative kind of components, actually. And weirdly, a kind of, I don't know if I'm right in saying this, but maybe it's just because that's what we were talking about. But actually, with quite a large group of children, like a class, actually something that is quite kind of adult initiated. I know there's that thing about you're there through choice, which doesn't really apply to school at all. But that an adult initiated opportunity to engage in something or to be in a place, rather than just it's playtime, do what the heck you want. It's actually like there is somebody holding that space a bit more tightly, so that there is no danger. Like, we're not going to be running into each other right now. You're going to have some people playing football next to you while you're trying to engage in something more low arousal, and all those kind of things that it requires, like a bit of a more tightly held container. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to iron out those problems of danger and deception, difficulty and distraction. And again, that's something that's kind of relevant to us kind of forest school practitioners when we're thinking about our sessions and free play. And I'm not saying that we then force everyone like, now we're all sitting down to do this thing, because obviously that overrides that thing of, you know, it being chosen. But in terms of kind of tweaking the environment and the opportunities so that this is available to people.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to consider how many people working in not just forest school, but like outdoor education, or actually I'm gonna say possibly broader into that, like social emotional support type learning, that how much we are allowed to consider our work as part of like a daily diet, or as part of a like weekly diet, as opposed to hypothetically you could have a range of specialist teachers, like in the secondary school environment, geography first thing, geography teachers going, right, hard focus for my hour and a half lesson. And then there's like a 2 minute handover. And then the maths teacher has got to go, right, hard focus for my two. Mm. And each person is going, I just need this bit of attention. I just need this bit of, you know, if you think of it like a battery, and then, you know, I just need this much, you know, I just need 20% of your attention, or another 20%, another 20%. It's never getting filled back up, because no one person, and that's different in primary school, at least here in the UK, because you have normally one teacher through the day, and you have a little bit more leeway, or I did when I was teaching, to go, I'm going to push and pull here a little bit. We're going to do this thing and this thing. And, you know, yeah, we'll stop that lesson a bit earlier, and we'll just, because I can feel the room needs this, or I can feel that. So how many then of us who do peripatetic forest school, who are like going in, are able to either have that handover conversation of like, what are the batteries like today? What's going on in the week? Do we need this stuff? And to go, okay, so as part of the diet of the week, this is what's needed here, as opposed to, I mean, I feel like I've talked myself around to reiterating that point, but again, that like, well, are you delivering nature connection? Are you delivering physical activity? Are you delivering risk? You know, you said risk was in forest school, so are you delivering risk, or are you delivering that? I want to see that sort of thing. And that's, and also that there is challenge here in terms of like, to understand the compatibility element of making an, because this is making an environment, not just like delivery. This is an environmental setting. So some of this is like, you could set up physical things like sheltered areas or the way the seating is set up or the timetabling of your session. Those things can change it. But to get through this list of going, like, if I had to make this list of things that I could make a restorative space for you, that's a hell of a lot of work just for me to get one ready for you.
Mm.
If you then expand it out and went, could I make one for like 5 adults? I go, yeah, but it won't be as good because I haven't got infinite time to do it. And also, what one person will find a distraction, another person will find their soft focus in, or, you know, what one person will find a danger, another person will find, you know, background noise. Mm. And so that's really interesting to think about how deep your relationship building has to be in order to not just recognize that you need to facilitate this, but then to go and facilitate it at different pockets of time or different people.
Yeah, I know. And that thing about the environment being familiar as well, that like the extent point, I was thinking about that whole like long-term quality of Forest School, that for so many adults and children that we're working with, the outdoors in general, let alone our woodland or site on a school field, wherever we're delivering, is going to be unfamiliar to them for such a variety of reasons based on where they live, on the color of their skin, on all these factors that could affect how comfortable somebody feels in the outdoors and whether they feel like they belong there or not.
Yeah.
And or through sensory sensitivities to things that are in the environment, that we need to, that's another lens through which to view people's engagement with Forest School in terms of this like restorative quality. And, you know, like you said at the beginning, it's, oh, Forest School is just brilliant for everyone. No, it actually isn't. Like some people just don't like it and it's not good for them, or it needs such a long time for their relationship with both the people and the place to, you know, drop into place, that you're only going to get this restorative quality once you feel at home in this outdoor environment. And there are so many people who don't. And I think those of us that are drawn to this kind of work are drawn to it because we feel at home in the environment. So we can sometimes overlook the fact that for some people, they just don't feel at home there. And it's going to take them ages to feel that before they can reach this kind of benefit. Just another thing to think about in terms of delivery and practice. I had a question, which was, there's some stuff about ADHD, isn't there, in the article? Did you?
Yes, did I did. And that? I do want to talk about that. Yes.
I had a question, which was, so obviously people who are ADHD will experience more challenge in this kind of world that authors are talking about, in like the modern world, loads of stimulation, loads of kind of distractions and stressors and all this kind of thing. And people with the ADHD are going to typically face more challenges in response to those. And I just wrote down as a thought while I was reading, why is it that so many folks with ADHD work in the outdoor sector, either in Forest School or in forestry or gardening, or I don't know. I feel like there is a higher percentage than normal. I'd love to see some actual research, but I feel like there is a higher percentage of people who are ADHD working in these sectors. And is it because of our kind of extreme sensitivity to mental fatigue and therefore our increased feeling of benefit to being in natural settings as described in this article? I just wondered.
Never go back to mundane marshmallows ever again. Forest School Cooking, the cookbook, covers everything from how to build and use different types of outdoor ovens, stoves, and equipment, right through to a range of different meals to keep anyone full and ready for the next adventure. Get your copy today on Amazon. Yeah, that's an interesting question, and obviously one that we can get to a scientific answer to just by you and I waffling.
Of course. Maybe this is another podcast episode where we kind of try and talk to somebody who has done some research on it. I think that would be cool, wouldn't it?
I think it's interesting, and it does. So my response to hearing that question is a thing I said to you probably about a month ago now, because I was reflecting on the fact that we've been doing this for like seven, eight years, something like that. And I was saying, I think there is a linear progression of both happiness and dysfunctionality in my own like way of working, and not putting any, you know, particular labels or diagnoses on anything. But I think there is something about linking it to this like idea of masking, and that and not having to mask being attention restorative.
Yeah,
that's the word. I haven't phrased that very well, but if you are in an office and you keep pointing out that the clock has ticked funny, or that did you realize that those shoes are going in a different, that there's patterns to those footsteps going past, or the pipes making a weird hiss, that is just distraction to a corporate overlord, right? But where you and I work, if we suddenly tune out and go, that guy's in the bush, oh look, there's somebody in the tree, it looks like we're better at our jobs because it comes across like we're better nature connected. So it's exactly the same
like behavior. Can I just clarify to the listeners
that when you say that guy is
in the bush, it's not like, oh, that random stranger.
Sorry, I've taken
into our childcare setting.
I've taken to calling like animals and plants he and him. It's a slightly West Country thing, but do you know what I mean? That like.
Yeah. Distractibility is a really great thing when you're outside because really you notice stuff.
Well, not just that you notice it, but also to people watching you deliver, it looks, I think the impression is, wow, not only were they running a session, but they got the chance to show the learners that woodpecker that arrived, or they really encouraged the children to listen to that train that was going past in the distance, or that actually it's just, you know, your brain going like, look, squirrel, look. I'm sorry, I know we were having a conversation, but like, and that in an outdoor setting is a professional plus.
Mm.
And you're not, you know, you don't have to mask it as much. Whereas in a lot of other jobs, you know, like when I was teaching, I don't know that I would have been conscious of that thought process in the same way, but like it would have been eating my attention reserves because I would have still been noticing things. It was someone's run out on the playground or this thing's happened, but for fear of derailing the lesson, I have to, you know, shut that all down. And you know,
or not, but
you can, that's just what I mean,
just
you
can don't shut it down and just have lessons which are very special.
But I think that is also, there's something interesting then, if you reflect, I think if we take that as a given, right? I've sussed that bit of science. No bar graphs or anything needed. Then an interesting thing is to then go look at these things about compatibility and distraction. The environment should not be distracting. It's highly stimulating because it requires little effort to sink into. If you consider yourself as the leader as part of the environment, that then can be interesting to reflect on, like, are you, you know, how much of like not professionally masking in any way and pointing out everything that happens and every thought that comes into your head and every new idea, and that is then not setting up your groups to have this like thing come back in. And I think that is something that for me personally, I really value you and I working as a level partnership, because when we're doing the circle, either reflection or start, or if we're explaining a game, If it was just my group, I would be monologuing a lot more. And I think I would more readily, if somebody else was working on something, jump in and go, oh, and can I just add a thing that does this and this and this? But because of the way we work, I hold a lot more of that back and keep those distractions from coming across. Basically, what I'm saying is, like, I have a vague level of politeness and not shouting over you and other people, and I deserve to be patted on the back for that.
Oh, wow. Well done.
Thanks, mate.
Really well done there.
Thanks.
Well done.
I'm a white cis man, and sometimes I have to hold in what I want to say.
Sometimes you need a medal for that shit.
Okay, thanks.
I definitely want to do a podcast on specifically ADHD in the outdoors, and there is loads of research on it, but I kind of want to talk to somebody about it. If anyone listening happens to be an expert on that, just drop us a line, yo.
Can I
go on?
Just, we skimmed over it really fast at the beginning, but the four states. So we've talked quite a lot about the restorative environment, which I think is right, because that's the thing that, as forest school leaders, we're more in control of, or that we can apply into our practice. If we were going to use a like play theory type thing, that's the like outer world. Whereas this process thing of restoration is the inner world that we don't necessarily have control of, but we can observe. So just to like reiterate it. So it was clear head, mental fatigue recovery, then soft fascination, then reflection. Do you think those four stages are observable in a learner, in any particular learner, or do you think they are like, is it possible? I mean, the soft fascination one, maybe, because you probably would see physical interaction with something, but, or maybe that's daydreaming or something. But it struck me as like an interesting theory that I don't know how I would, without directly verbalizing with someone, hey, how is your attention doing? Have you managed to go through these things? And like forcing that framework onto them of like, well, do you think you're here? Or do you think you're here? Or do you like, can you observe that happening in someone to see if your restorative environment has worked?
Could you flip it round and make it apply to yourself? So as somebody who is in nature much more often and for longer periods of time than your average adult in the UK anyway, can you kind of map for yourself like where you are on that continuum at different points? Because you are still part of the group, and I don't just mean necessarily when you're running sessions, but also when you're just in the woods yourself. Because I think there are times when, especially in like longer sessions with groups that we've known for a long time, where the community is quite strong, where I get to level three, which is that like soft fascination or interest. You know, when you get those, I don't know if you feel this, where you get little bubbles of time where everyone's good. Everyone's no one's needing like one-to-one support with anything in terms of tool use or emotions or anything like that. And you might be alongside some learners involved in something, but rather than kind of being above it and just like eyes in the back of my head, is everybody okay? Let me supervise that thing. You just have these tiny little pockets of moments where actually we're all the same. We're all doing the same thing. And yeah, of course, if something happened, I'm there and I'm on it and I can flip out of it. Yeah. I'm not so absorbed that like, I'm, you know, I'm still at work, but those little moments where afterwards you're like, oh yeah, I actually did get a chance to be in soft fascination where I was doing something and that bit of my brain was able to kind of really take stock. Mindfulness, I guess, is that's the other thing that I kept thinking of when I was reading through this. I was like, there are links here with mindfulness and meditation in terms of just having like a a focus on something, but it's a soft focus. And the way you get a clearer head is not by pushing those thoughts and concerns away. It's about just letting them flow and moving past them, which is that's the kind of mindfulness and meditation approach to that as well, isn't it? And I definitely think that through being in a natural environment, I often get to that. And I wonder whether the sort of long-term sort of drip feed effect has happened to us in terms of getting to number four, the like reflection or restoration, that is like super long-term, maybe, I wonder.
I'm not sure. I think it's interesting that stage two of four has the word recovery in it, mental fatigue recovery, because I definitely think I get that, but I get that in the distance between leaving the main camp area and walking down to some people are playing at the treehouse and I'm just on my way to go do that. The meditative walking between point A and point B, I have gotten a lot better at giving myself that walk is mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say that can go into soft fascination. That walk is not enough time, or because I'm going somewhere with a purpose, I can't then come out of it and go, or not come out of it. Do you know what I mean? I can't get distracted by birds on the way, or
I know. And I was thinking about like, oh, what about moments where we find like an amazing insect and we're like completely absorbed in that? But that isn't soft fascination. That is definitely hard fascination, isn't it?
But you said you think you get to number three. So what, could you give me some examples of what your soft?
Yeah. So I know I keep coming back to it, but like doing like five-fingered weaving. So times when I might have, you know, I've got to make this because I want to show it to somebody so that they know what it is, or someone's doing it next to me, and so I'm also doing it. So those, yeah, for me, those moments of handwork, or like I've got the clay out and these learners are playing with clay and I'm just with them also playing with clay. And it's kind of quiet and there might be some chat and they might be chatting to each other and I don't want to intrude and I'm just there. Or like lighting a fire, for example, wouldn't be the case if I was new to fire lighting, but like lighting a fire to boil some water, it's such a habitual process and it is just absorbing enough to be able to do it and have a little bit of restoration at the same time. Obviously not if it's in a challenging circumstance.
Applications to complete Level 3 Forest School Leader Training here with us at Children of the Forest are now open. Train with me and Lewis at our woodland site in Devon. We'd love to meet you in person. Visit myforestschooltraining.co.uk to find out more.
Is this the same concept to you as the like Steinery Waldorf approach of handwork to keep something going so that you can have? Because those examples, I'll tell you why I've made that link, is because those examples you just gave of like getting the fire lit or doing like the nesting rings we've been making the last month or so, they are very meditative and in that state. But I would say in those moments, I am with whoever I'm with doing a greater amount of like social and emotional processing, watching faces, watching body language, slightly monitoring like that person's talking a lot, that person hasn't had a chance to speak next, maybe I should offer them.
Well,
that
that's what I mean, it's like those moments where actually everyone's fine and you just get and I describe it as a tiny bubble, because often most of the time, yes. But especially on like a sunny day when, you can hear noises and like there is a bit of your brain that's always alert, of course, for like any kind of noise that might indicate that someone needs you. But just the gap in between those, like you're needed for something, is just long enough to have a little moment. Or
I think if I'm with people, I'm focusing. And I think the less that's going on, almost the more I'm focusing, because I want to start interpreting, understanding what's going on, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think during sessions, I personally wouldn't say I get to this true soft mm-hmm. fascination thing. But I definitely get moments of clear head and mental fatigue recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I think the soft fascination comes.
What about like when you're splitting wood?
That's what I was going to say. It's close to flow state, isn't
yeah.
it? When
yeah.
you're doing that thing, like splitting wood does that. And I was saying to you the other day, like putting up shelters,
mm-hmm.
putting up tarp roofs, because I am my level of competency with the yeah. knots and the shape yeah, of the yeah. thing is just like do 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 do
yeah.
that, like yeah. that's but I can only do that, I would say, like we said in the last podcast, before people get there.
Yeah.
That's my like, and that's often where you sit, like you come in the morning and go, geez, you've been productive this morning. It's because yeah. I've got my kids dressed and fed, and then my attention recovery is putting up a shelter, cutting down that thing, splitting the wood, so that I've refilled my cup for the session.
Yeah.
Nice.
I think,
yeah. I would be interested to look at, in that article you sent, there were some interesting bits at the bottom that I don't think we've got time to go into because we'll be here for another hour. But one of them was like, why does hard fascination preclude reflection?
Mm.
So there was a lot in this Kaplan work where they were saying that nobody reflects when they're doing, you know, hard fascination stuff, which is interesting.
Mm.
Not necessarily saying it's untrue, but like, why is that? Why can't we do that thing? And then why are fascinating stimuli relatively effortless rather than effortful? Which I think again is similar to that thing of the description, all the examples they gave of the soft fascination were physically easy, low energy. But I think you could probably speak to a lot of people who like, particularly say like long distance runners. I know lots of people who are not competitive, but like, you know, amateur long distance runners, and they talk about the headspace they get from running and they're physically exerting themselves, but they are a way, they have got a fascination, they're compatible with where they're running because they're not constantly yep. worried about danger or all those things. So there's yeah. some interesting loophole yeah. exceptions in this idea, but I do really like it as a framework to, I guess the metaphor would be like to assess how safe your harbor actually is. And we talk about like being a safe harbor or facilitating a safe harbor, but this is kind of like a checklist to go, right, but in what way? Are you doing it in all the ways or are you just doing it in this one way?
Yeah. And there's lots you could read about whether this theory holds any water at all. There was University of Exeter thing, there was some kind of challenge there about like the research done actually, you know, was it rigorous enough to definitely kind of back this up? But as long as it's just one of those things, like you say, about having another arrow in your quiver in terms of like, if I can in some way facilitate a bit of this along the way, that might be cool. Yes.
Definitely. Oh, well, I feel like we've chatted the world away.
Yes.
I will see you listeners next time. Boema, we'll see you in a bit for our Patreon podcast.
Yes.
We're doing more things. What should we do? Cooking. Should we do a bit about cooking?
Let's do a bit about cooking. So for listeners who don't know what we're on about, we obviously the podcast is always free and always has been and always will be, but for those people who'd like to support us a bit more and also get a bit more content related directly to forest school practice and sort of little bits of advice or practical tips that we find helpful running our setting, we have started to record some extra content for people who support us monthly via Patreon. I guess you can find it from Children of the Forest, like patreon.com/Children of the Forest, is that right?
That's right. That's where it is.
If you're interested, and that's available all over the world. And thank you very much to those people who already support us in this way. We had somebody recently support us, I think from Canada. So thank you to you. Yeah, let's go and record some
it's
stuff.
Sarah, thanks, Sarah.
Cooking go-tos. Yeah, thank you. Very, very appreciative of that.
Gosh. Yeah. Right. See you in a bit,
bye,
mate.
Everyone. Bye. Bye.
You can get ad-free episodes of the Forest School podcast, as well as bonus episodes and exclusive access to upcoming guests to ask them questions before anybody else finds out about it, simply by visiting patreon.com/children of the forest.